He imagined her joy upon reading the article about him, and for an instant he felt maternal pride toward himself. Not only that, but a maternal tear burned the edge of his eyelids. Oh, but what do I care whether or not I receive attention during my lifetime, if I am not certain that the world will remember me until its last darkest winter, marveling like Ronsard's old woman? And yet, I'm still a long way from 30, and here today I am already noticed. Noticed! Thank you, my land, for this remotest. A lyric possibility flitted past, singing quite close to his ear. Thank you, my land, for your most precious. I no longer need thee, sound Otis. The rhyme has kindled life, but the rhyme itself is abandoned. And maddest gift, my thanks are due. I suppose meshes waits in the wings. Did not have time to make out my third line in that burst of light. Pity. All gone now. Missed my cue. He brought some piroshki, one with meat, another with cabbage, a third with tapioca, a fourth with rice, a fifth, could not afford a fifth. In a Russian food shop, which was a kind of wax museum of the old country's cuisine, and quickly finished them off on a damp bench in a small public garden. The rain began coming down faster. Someone had suddenly tilted the sky. He had to take cover in the circular shelter at the streetcar stop. There on the bench, two Germans with briefcases were discussing a deal and endowing it with such dialectic details that the nature of the merchandise was lost, as when you're looking through an article in Brockhaus's encyclopedia and lose its subject, indicated in the text only by its initial letter. Shaking her bobbed hair, a girl entered the shelter with a small, wheezing, toad-like bulldog. Now, this is odd. Remotest and noticed are together again, and a certain combination is ringing persistently. I will not be tempted. The shower ended. With perfect simplicity, no dramatics, no tricks, all the street lamps came on. He decided he could already set off for the Chernyshevskys, so as to be there towards 9. Rhine, fine, Klein. As happens with drunks, something preserved him when he crossed streets in this state. Illuminated by a street lamp's humid ray, a car stood at the curb with its motor running. Every single drop on its hood was trembling. Who could have written it? Fyodor could not make a final choice among several émigré critics. This one was scrupulous, but untalented. That one dishonest, but gifted. A third wrote only about prose, a fourth only about his friends. A fifth, and Fyodor's imagination conjured up this fifth one, a man the same age as he, or even he thought a year younger, who had published during those same years in those same émigré papers and magazines no more than he, a poem here, an article there, but who in some incomprehensible manner, which seemed as physically natural as some kind of emanation, had unobtrusively clothed himself in an aura of indefinable fame, so that his name was uttered not necessarily especially often, but quite differently from all the other young names. A man whose every new searing line he, Fyodor, despising himself, quickly and avidly devoured in a corner, trying by the very act of reading to destroy the marvel of it. After which, for 2 days or so, he could not rid himself either of what he had read or of his own feeling of debility, or of a secret ache, as if while wrestling with another he had injured his own innermost sacrosanct particle. A lonely, unpleasant, myopic man with some kind of unpleasant defect in the reciprocal position of his shoulder blades. But I shall forgive everything if it is you. He thought he was keeping his pace to a dawdle, yet the clocks that he came across on the way, the emergent giants of watchmakers' shops, advanced even more slowly. And when almost at his destination, he overtook in one stride Lyubov Markovna, who was going to the same place, he understood that he had been borne along throughout his journey by his impatience, as by an escalator that transforms even a motionless man into a runner. Why did this flabby, unloved elderly woman still make up her eyes when she already wore a pince-nez? The lenses exaggerated the unsteadiness and crudity of the amateurish ornamentation, and as a result, her perfectly innocent gaze became so ambiguous that one could not break away from it. The hypnosis of error. In fact, nearly everything about her seemed based on an unfortunate misunderstanding, and one wondered if it was not even a form of insanity when she thought that she spoke German like a native, that Galsworthy was a great writer, or that Georgi Ivanovich Vasilyev was pathologically attracted to her. She was one of the most faithful frequenters of the literary parties that the Chernyshevskys, together with Vasilyev, a fat old journalist, organized every other Saturday. Today was only Tuesday. And Lyubov Markovna was still living on her impressions from the previous Saturday, sharing them generously. Men fatally became absent-minded boors in her company. Fyodor himself felt he was slipping, too, but fortunately they were coming to the front door, and there the Chernyshevsky's maid already stood waiting, keys in hand. Actually, she had been sent to meet Vasilyev, who suffered from an extremely rare disease of the heart valves. He had, in fact, made a hobby of it, and sometimes arrived at the home of friends with an anatomical model of the heart, and demonstrated everything very clearly and lovingly. "We don't need the elevator," said Lyubov Markovna, and started up the stairs with a strong, plodding gait, which turned to a curiously smooth and silent swing on the landings. Fyodor had to zigzag behind her at a reduced pace, as you sometimes see a dog do, weaving and shoving its nose past its master's heel, now on the right, now on the left. They were admitted by Alexandra Yakovlevna herself. Fyodor had scarcely time to notice her unusual expression, as if she disapproved of something or wanted to avert something quickly, when her husband darted into the hallway on his short, plump legs, waving a newspaper as he ran. "Here it is!" he shouted, the corner of his mouth violently jerking downward, a tic acquired since the death of his son. "Look, here it is!" "When I married him," observed Madame Chernyshevsky, "I expected his humor to be more subtle." Fyodor saw with surprise that the paper he uncertainly took from his host was a German one. "The date!" shouted Chernyshevsky. "Go ahead, look at the date, young man!" "April 1st, said Fyodor with a sigh, and unconsciously he folded up the paper. "Yes, of course, I should have remembered." Chernyshevsky began to guffaw ferociously. "Don't be cross with him, please," said his wife in an indolently sorrowful tone, slightly rolling her hips and gently taking the young man by the wrist. Lyubov Markovna clicked her purse shut and sailed off toward the parlor. It was a smallish, rather tastelessly furnished, badly lighted room, with a shadow lingering in one corner and a pseudo-Tanagra vase standing on an unattainable shelf. And when at last the final guest had arrived, and Madame Chernyshevsky, becoming for a moment, as usually happens, remarkably similar to her own blue, gleaming teapot, began to pour tea, the cramped quarters assumed the guise of a certain touching provincial coziness. On the sofa, among cushions of various hue, all of them unappetizing and blurry, a silk doll with an angel's limp legs and a Persian's almond-shaped eyes was being squeezed alternately by two comfortably settled persons. Vasilyev, huge, bearded, wearing pre-war socks arrowed above the ankle, and a fragile, charmingly debilitated girl with pink eyelids, in general appearance rather like a white mouse. Her first name was Tamara, which would have better suited the doll, and her last was reminiscent of one of those German mountain landscapes that hang in picture-framing shops. Fyodor sat by the bookshelf and tried to simulate good spirits, despite the lump in his throat. Kern, a civil engineer who prided himself on having been a close acquaintance of the late Alexander Bloch, the celebrated poet, was producing a gluey sound as he extracted a date from an oblong carton. Lyubov Markovna carefully examined the pastries on a large plate with a poorly pictured bumblebee, and, suddenly botching her investigation, contented herself with a bun, the sugar-powdered kind that always bears an anonymous fingerprint. The host was telling an ancient story about a medical student's April Fool's prank in Kiev. But the most interesting person in the room sat a little distance apart, by the writing desk, and did not take part in the general conversation, which, however, he followed with quiet attention. He was a youth somewhat resembling Fyodor, not so much in facial features, which at that moment were difficult to distinguish, but in the tonality of his general appearance. The dunnish auburn shade of the round head, which was closely cropped, a style which, according to the rules of latter-day St. Petersburg romanticism, was more becoming to a poet than shaggy locks. The transparency of the large, tender, slightly protruding ears, the slenderness of the neck, with the shadow of a hollow at its nape. He sat in the same pose Fyodor sometimes assumed, head slightly lowered, legs crossed, arms not so much crossed as hugging each other, as if he felt chilled, so that the repose of the body was expressed more by angular projections, knee, elbow, thin shoulder, and the contraction of all the members, rather than by the general softening of the frame when a person is relaxing and listening. The shadows of two volumes standing on the desk mimicked a cuff and the corner of a lapel, while the shadow of a third volume, which was leaning against the others, might have passed for a necktie. He was about 5 years younger than Fyodor, and as far as the face itself was concerned, if one judged by the photographs on the walls of the room and in the adjacent bedroom, on the little table between twin beds that wept at night, there was perhaps no resemblance at all, if you discounted a certain elongation of outline combined with prominent frontal bones and the dark depth of the eye sockets, Pascal-like, according to the physiognomists, and also there might have been something in common in the breadth of the eyebrows. But no, it was not a matter of ordinary resemblance, but of generic spiritual similarity between two angular and sensitive boys, each odd in his own way. This youth sat with downcast eyes and a trace of mockery on his lips, in a modest, not very comfortable position, on a chair along whose seat copper tacks glinted, to the left of the dictionary-cluttered desk. And Alexander Yakovlevich Chernyshevsky, with a convulsive effort, as if regaining lost balance, would tear his gaze away from that shadowy youth as he went on with the jaunty banter behind which he tried to conceal his mental sickness. "Don't worry, there'll be reviews," he said to Fyodor, winking involuntarily. "You can be sure the critics will squeeze out your blackheads." "By the way," asked his wife, "what do those weavers and wavers mean exactly in the poem about the bicycle?" Fyodor explained, relying more on gestures than on words. "You know, when you're learning to ride a bike and you sort of swerve from side to side." "Doubtful expression," remarked Vasilyev. "My favorite is the one about children's diseases." "Yes," said Alexandra Yakovlevna, nodding to herself. "That's good. Christmas-time scarlet fever and Easter-time diphtheria." "Why not the other way around?" inquired Tamara. Oh, how the boy had loved poetry. The glass-doored bookcase in the bedroom was full of his books. Gumilyov and Heredia, Bloch and Rilke. And how much he knew by heart. And the notebooks. One day, she and I will have to sit down and go through it all. She has the strength to do it, I don't. Strange how one keeps postponing things. One would think it would be a pleasure, the bitter pleasure, to go through the belongings of the dead. Yet his stuff goes on lying there untouched. The provident laziness of one's soul. It is unthinkable that a stranger should touch it. But what a relief it would be if an accidental fire were to destroy that precious little cabinet. Chernyshevsky abruptly got up and, as if by chance, moved the chair by the desk in such a way that neither it nor the shadows of the books could serve as a theme for the phantom. By then, The talk had shifted to some unlamented Soviet politician who had fallen from power after Lenin's death. Oh, in the years I knew him, he was at the height of glory and good deeds, the journalist Vasilyev was saying, professionally misquoting Pushkin, who has hope, not height. The boy who looked like Fyodor, to whom the Chernyshevskys had become so attached for this very reason, was now by the door, where he paused before leaving the room, half turning toward his father. And despite his purely imaginary nature, how much more substantial he was than all those sitting in the room. The sofa could be seen through Vasilyev and the pale girl. Cairn, the engineer, was represented only by the glint of his pince-nez. So was Lyubov Markovna. And Fyodor himself existed only because of a vague congruity with the deceased. While Yasha was perfectly real and live, and only the instinct of self-preservation prevented one from taking a good look at his features. But perhaps, thought Fyodor, perhaps this is all wrong. Perhaps he, Alexander Yakovlevich Chernyshevsky, is not imagining his dead son at all right now, as I imagine him doing. He may be really occupied with the conversation, and if his eyes are wandering, it may be only because he has always been fidgety, poor soul. I'm unhappy, I'm bored. Nothing rings true here, and I don't know why I keep sitting here listening to nonsense. However, he still continued to sit there and smoke and gently swing the toe of his foot. And while the others talked on, and he talked on himself, he tried, as he did everywhere and always, to imagine the inner, transparent motion of this or that other person. He would carefully seat himself inside the interlocutor as in an armchair, so that the other's elbows would serve as armrests for him, and his soul would fit snugly into the other's soul. And then the lighting of the world would suddenly change, and for a minute he would actually become Alexander Chernyshevsky, or Lyubov Markovna, or Vasilya. Sometimes a sporting excitement would be added to the seltzer-like effervescence of the transformation, and he felt flattered when a chance word aptly confirmed the train of thought he was divining in the other. He, to whom so-called politics, that ridiculous sequence of pacts, conflicts, aggravations, frictions, discords, collapses, and the transformation of perfectly innocent little towns into the names of international treaties, meant nothing, would sometimes immerse himself with a thrill of curiosity and revulsion into the vast bowels of Vasilyev, and live for an instant actuated by his, Vasilyev's, inner mechanism, where next to the Locarno button there was one for lockout, and where a pseudo-clever, pseudo-entertaining game was conducted by such ill-matched symbols as the Five Kremlin Rulers, or the Kurd Rebellion, or individual surnames that had lost all human connotations. Hindenburg, Marx, Painleve, Heriot, whose macrocephalic initial in Russian, the reverse E, had become so autonomous in the columns of Vasilyev's Gazeta as to threaten a complete rift with the original Frenchman. This was a world of prophetic utterances, presentiments, mysterious combinations, a world that was in fact a hundredfold more spectral than the most abstract dream. And when Fyodor moved over into Madame Chernyshevsky, he found himself within a soul where not everything was alien to him, but where he marveled at many things, as a prim traveler might marvel at the customs in a distant land. The bazaar at sunrise, the naked children, the din, the monstrous size of fruit. This 45-year-old, plain, indolent woman, who 2 years ago had lost her only son, had suddenly come alive. Morning had given her wings and tears had rejuvenated her. Or, at any rate, so said those who had known her before. The memory of her son, which in her husband had become an illness, burned in her with a quickening fervor. It would be incorrect to say that this fervor filled her completely. No, it far exceeded the confines of her soul, seeming even to ennoble the absurdity of these two rented rooms, into which, after the tragedy, she and her husband had moved from the large Intenzelten apartment, where her brother had lived with his family back in the years before the war. Now she regarded all her friends only in the light of their receptivity toward her loss, and also, for greater precision, recalled or imagined Yasha's opinion of this or that individual with whom she had to keep up acquaintance. She was seized with the fever of activity, with the thirst for an abundant response. Her child grew within her and struggled to issue forth. The literary circle newly founded by her husband jointly with Vasilyev, in order to give himself and her something to do, seemed to her the best possible posthumous honor for her poet son. It was just at that time that I first saw her and was more than a little perplexed when suddenly this plump, terribly animated little woman with dazzling blue eyes burst into tears in the midst of her first conversation with me, as if a brimful crystal vessel had broken for no apparent reason, and without taking her dancing gaze off me, laughing and sobbing, started saying over and over, "Goodness, how you remind me of him!" The frankness with which, during our subsequent meetings, she spoke about her son, about all the details of his death, and about the way she now dreamed of him, as if big with him and as translucent as a bubble, seemed to me vulgar and shameless. It irked me even more when I learned indirectly that she was a little hurt that I did not answer her with corresponding vibrations, but instead only changed the subject the moment she mentioned my own grief, my own loss. Very soon, however, I noticed that this rapture of sorrow in which she managed to live without dying of a ruptured aorta was beginning somehow to draw me in and make demands on me. You know that characteristic movement when someone hands you a treasured photograph and watches you in anticipation, and you, having lengthily and piously gazed at the face in the snapshot, which smiles innocently and without a thought of death, feign to delay its return, feign to retard your own hand, while with a lingering glance you give back the picture as if it would have been impolite to part with it sooner. This sequence of movements she and I repeated endlessly. Her husband would sit at his brightly lit desk in the corner, working and occasionally clearing his throat. He was compiling his dictionary of Russian technical terms, commissioned by a German publisher. All was quiet and wrong. The remains of cherry jam mingled with cigarette ash in my saucer. The more she continued to tell about Yasha, the less attractive he grew. Oh, no, he and I bore little resemblance to each other, far less than she supposed, projecting inward the coincidental similarity of external features, of which, moreover, she found additional ones that did not exist. In reality, the little there was within us corresponded to the little there was without, and I doubt we would have become friends if he and I had ever met. His somberness, interrupted by the sudden shrill gaiety characteristic of humorless people, the sentimentality of his intellectual enthusiasms, his purity, which would have strongly suggested timidity of the senses were it not for the morbid over-refinement of their interpretation, his feeling for Germany, his tasteless spiritual throes. For a whole week, he said, I was in a daze after reading Spengler. And finally, his poetry. In short, everything that to his mother was filled with enchantment only repelled me. As a poet, he was, in my opinion, very feeble. He did not create. He merely dabbled in poetry, just as thousands of intelligent youths of his type did. But if they did not meet with some kind of more or less heroic death, having nothing to do with Russian letters, which, however, they knew meticulously, oh, those notebooks of Yasha's filled with prosodic diagrams expressing modulations of rhythm in the tetrameter, they subsequently abandoned literature altogether. And if they exhibited talent in some field, it would be in science or administration, or else simply in a well-ordered life. His poems, replete with fashionable clichés, exalted his grievous love of Russia. autumn scenes a la Yesenin, the smoky blue of blockish bogs, the powder snow upon the wooden paving blocks of Mandelstam's neoclassicism, and the Nevaz granite parapet on which one can scarcely discern today the imprint of Pushkin's elbow. His mother would read them to me, stumbling in her agitation, with an awkward schoolgirl intonation which did not at all suit those tragically scudded iambics. Yasha himself must have recited them in an oblivious sing-song, dilating his nostrils and swaying in the bizarre blaze of a kind of lyric pride, after which he would immediately sink back, again become humble, limp, and withdrawn. The sonorous epithets that lived in his throat, Nivriyatni, incredible, Chladni, cold, Prekrasni, beautiful, epithets avidly employed by the young poets of his generation under the delusion that archaisms, prosaisms, or simply destitute words, having completed their life cycle, now, when used in poems, gained a kind of unexpected freshness, returning from the opposite direction. These words in Madame Chernyshevsky's stumbling diction made, as it were, another half-cycle, faded away again, and again revealed their decrepit poverty, thus exposing the deception of style. Besides patriotic elegies, Yasha had poems about the low haunts of adventurous sailors, about gin and jazz, which he pronounced in the German way as Yachts, and poems about Berlin, in which he attempted to endow German proper names with a lyric voice in the same way, for instance, as Italian street names resound in Russian poetry with a suspiciously euphonious contralto. He also had poems dedicated to friendship, without rhyme and without meter, full of muddled, hazy, and timid emotions, of some internal spiritual bickerings, and apostrophes to a male friend in the polite form, the Russian vu, as a sick Frenchman addresses God, or a young Russian poetress, her favorite gentleman. And all this was expressed in a pale, haphazard manner with many vulgarisms and incorrect word accents peculiar to his provincial middle-class set. Misled by its augmentative suffix, he assumed that pozharishche, the site of a recent fire, meant a big fire. And I also remember a rather pathetic reference to Vrublev's frescoes, an amusing cross between two Russian painters, Rublev and Vrubel, that only served to prove our dissimilarity. No, he could not have loved painting as I do. My true opinion of his poetry I concealed from his mother, while the forced sounds of inarticulate approbation that I politely made were construed by her as signs of incoherent rapture. For my birthday, she gave me, beaming through her tears, Yasha's best necktie, an old-fashioned affair of watered silk, freshly ironed, with, still discernible, the label of a well-known but not elegant shop. I hardly think Yasha himself ever wore it. And in exchange for everything which she had shared with me, for her giving me a complete and detailed image of her late son, with his poetry, his neurasthenia, his enthusiasms, his death, Madame Chernyshevsky imperiously demanded from me a certain amount of creative collaboration. Her husband, who was proud of his century-old name and spent hours entertaining guests with its history, his grandfather had been baptized in the reign of Nicholas I, in Polsk, I believe, by the father of the famous political writer Chernyshevsky, a stout, energetic Greek Orthodox priest, who liked to do missionary work among the Jews, and who, on top of the spiritual benison, would bestow upon converts the added bonus of his last name, said to me on numerous occasions, "Look, you ought to write a little book in the form of a biographie romancée about our great man of the 60s. Now, now, stop frowning. I can foresee all your objections. But believe me, there are, after all, cases where the fascinating beauty of a good man's dedicated life fully redeems the falsity of his literary views. And Nikolai Chernyshevsky was indeed a heroic soul. If you should decide to describe his life, there are many curious things I could tell you." I had no desire at all to write about the great man of the 60s, and even less to write about Yasha, as his mother persistently counseled for her part. So that, taken together, here was an order for a complete history of their family. But while I was both amused and irritated by these efforts of theirs to channel my muse, I nevertheless felt that before long Madame Chernyshevsky would have me cornered. And just as I was compelled to put on Yasha's necktie on my visits to her, until it occurred to me to say I was saving it for special occasions, I would have to undertake writing a long short story depicting Yasha's fate. At one time, I was even weak enough, or bold enough, perhaps, to ponder how I might tackle the subject, if by any chance any corny man of ideas, any serious novelist in horn-rimmed glasses, the family doctor of Europe and the seismographer of its social tremors, would no doubt have found in this story something highly characteristic of the frame of mind of young people in the post-war years. A combination of words which in itself, even apart from the general idea it conveyed, made me speechless with scorn. I used to feel a cloying nausea when I heard or read the latest drivel, vulgar and humorless drivel, about the symptoms of the age and the tragedy of youth. And since I could not be kindled by Yasha's tragedy, though his mother did think I was a fire, I would have become enmired involuntarily in a deep social interest novel with a disgusting Freudian reek. My heart stood still as I exercised my imagination, probing with my toe, as it were, the mica-thin ice over the puddle. I would go so far as to picture myself making a fair copy of my work and bringing it to Madame Chernyshevsky, seating myself in such a way that the lamp would illuminate my fatal road from the left. Thank you, I can see fine this way. And after a brief foreword about how difficult it had been, about the sense of responsibility I felt... But here, everything would be obscured by the crimson mist of shame. Fortunately, I did not fulfill the order. I'm not sure exactly what saved me. For one thing, I kept putting it off too long. For another, certain blessed intervals occurred between our meetings. And then perhaps Madame Chernyshevsky herself grew a little bored with me as a listener. Be that as it may, the story remained unused by the writer. A story that was, in fact, very simple and sad. Yasha and I had entered Berlin University at almost exactly the same time, but I did not know him, although we must have passed each other many times. Diversity of subjects, he took philosophy, I studied infusoria, diminished the possibility of our association. If I were to return now into that past, enriched in but one respect, awareness of the present day, and retrace exactly all my interlooping steps, then I would certainly notice his face, now so familiar to me through snapshots. It is a funny thing when you imagine yourself returning into the past with the contraband of the present, how weird it would be to encounter there, in unexpected places, the prototypes of today's acquaintances, so young and fresh, who in a kind of lucid lunacy do not recognize you. Thus, a woman, for instance, whom one loves since yesterday, appears as a young girl standing practically next to one in a crowded train. While the chance passerby who 15 years ago asked you the way in the street now works in the same office as you. Among this throng of the past, only a dozen or so faces would acquire this anachronistic importance. Low cards, transfigured by the radiance of the trump. And then how confidently one could... But alas, even when you do happen in a dream to make such a return journey, then at the border of the past, your present intellect is completely invalidated. And amid the surroundings of a classroom hastily assembled by the nightmare's clumsy property man, you again do not know your lesson, with all the forgotten shades of those school throes of old. At the university, Yasha made close friends with two fellow students, Rudolf Baumann, a German, and Olya G., a compatriot. The Russian language papers did not print her name in full. She was a girl of his age and set, even, I think, from the same town as he. Their families, however, were not acquainted. Only once did I have a chance to see her, at a literary soiree about 2 years after Yasha's death. I remember her remarkably broad and clear forehead, her aquamarine eyes, and her large red mouth with black fuzz over the upper lip and a plump mole at the wick. She stood with her arms folded across her soft bosom, at once arousing in me all the proper literary associations, such as the dust of a fair summer evening and the threshold of a highway tavern and a bored girl's observant gaze. As for Rudolf, I never saw him myself, and can conclude only from the words of others that he had pale blonde hair brushed back, was swift in his movements and handsome, in a hard, sinewy way, remindful of a gun dog. Thus I use a different method to study each of the three individuals, which affects both their substance and their coloration, until, at the last minute, the rays of a sun that is my own and yet is incomprehensible to me strikes them and equalizes them in the same burst of light. Yasha kept a diary, and in those notes he neatly defined the mutual relationship between him, Rudolf, and Olya as a triangle inscribed in a circle. The circle represented the normal, simple, Euclidean, as he put it, friendship that united all three, so that if it alone had existed, their union would have remained happy, carefree, and unbroken. But the triangle inscribed within it was a different system of relationships, complex, agonizing, and slow in forming, which had an existence of its own, quite independent of its common enclosure of uniform friendship. This was the banal triangle of tragedy, formed within an idyllic circle, and the mere presence of such a suspiciously neat structure, to say nothing of the fashionable counterpoint of its development, would never have permitted me to make it into a short story or novel. "I am fiercely in love with the soul of Rudolf," wrote Yasha in his agitated neo-romantic style. "I love its harmonious proportions, its health, the joy it has in living. I am fiercely in love with this naked, suntanned, lithe soul, which has an answer to everything, and proceeds through life as a self-confident woman does across a ballroom floor. I can imagine only in the most complex, abstract manner, next to which Kant and Hegel are child's play, the fierce ecstasy I would experience if only... if only what? What can I do with his soul? This is what kills me, this yearning for some most mysterious tool. Thus Albrecht Koch yearned for golden logic in the world of madmen. My blood throbs, my hands grow icy like a schoolgirl's when I remain alone with him, and he knows this, and I become repulsive to him, and he does not conceal his disgust. I am fiercely in love with his soul, and this is just as fruitless as falling in love with the moon." Rudolf's squeamishness is understandable, but if one looks at the matter more closely, one suspects that Yasha's passion was perhaps not so abnormal after all, that his excitement was, after all, very much akin to that of many a Russian youth in the middle of last century, trembling with happiness when raising his silky eyelashes, his pale-browed teacher, a future leader, a future martyr, would turn to him. And I would have refused to see in Yasha's case an incorrigible deviation had Rudolf been to the least degree a teacher, a martyr, or a leader, and not what he really was, a so-called Bursch, a German regular guy, notwithstanding a certain propensity for obscure poetry, lame music, lopsided art, which did not affect in him that fundamental soundness by which Yasha was captivated, or thought he was. The son of a respectable fool of a professor and a civil servant's daughter, he had grown up in wonderful bourgeois surroundings, between a cathedral-like sideboard and the backs of dormant books. He was good-natured, although not good. sociable and yet a little skittish, impulsive and at the same time calculating. He fell in love with Olya conclusively after a bicycle ride with her and Yasha in the Black Forest, a tour which, as he later testified at the inquest, was an eye-opener for all three of us. He fell in love with her on the lowest level, primitively and impatiently, but from her he received a sharp rebuff, made all the stronger by the fact that Olya, an indolent, grasping, morosely freakish girl, had in her turn, in those same fir woods, by the same round black lake, realized she had fallen for Yasha, who was just as oppressed by this as Rudolf was by Yasha's ardor, and as she herself was by the ardor of Rudolf, so that the geometric relationship of their inscribed feelings was complete, reminding one of the traditional and somewhat mysterious interconnections in the dramatis personae of 18th century French playwrights, where X is the amant of Y, the one in love with Y, and Y is the amant of Z, the one in love with Z. By winter, the second winter of their friendship, they had become clearly aware of the situation. The winter was spent in studying its hopelessness. On the surface, everything seemed to be fine. Yasha read incessantly. Rudolf played hockey, masterfully speeding the puck across the ice. Olya studied the history of art, which in the context of the epoch sounds, as does the tone of the entire drama in question, like an unbearably typical and therefore false note. Within, however, a hidden, agonizing torment was growing, which became formidably destructive the moment that these unfortunate young people began to find some pleasure in their threefold torture. For a long time, they abided by a tacit agreement, each knowing shamelessly and hopelessly everything about the others, never to mention their feelings when the three of them were together. But whenever one of them was absent, the other, too, would inevitably set to discussing his passion and his suffering. For some reason, they celebrated New Year's Eve in the restaurant of one of the Berlin railroad stations, perhaps because at railroad stations the armament of time is particularly impressive, and then they went slouching through the varicolored slush of grim, festive streets, and Rudolf ironically proposed a toast to the exposure of their friendship. And since that time, at first discreetly, but soon with all the rapture of frankness, they would jointly discuss their feelings with all three present. It was then that the triangle began to erode its circumference. The elder Chernyshevskys, as well as Rudolf's parents and Olya's mother, a sculptress, obese, black-eyed, and still handsome, with a low voice, who had buried two husbands and used to wear long necklaces that looked like bronze chains, not only did not sense that something doomful was growing, but would have confidently replied, should an aimless questioner have turned up among the angels already converging, already swarming and fussing professionally around the cradle where lay a dark little newborn revolver, that everything was all right, that everybody was happy. Afterwards, though, when everything had happened, their cheated memories made every effort to find in the routine past course of identically tinted days traces and evidence of what was to come. And, surprisingly, they would find them. Thus, Madame G., paying a call of condolence on Madame Chernyshevsky, fully believed what she was saying when she insisted she had had presentiments of the tragedy for a long time, since the very day when she had come into the half-dark drawing-room, where in motionless poses on a couch, in the various sorrowful inclinations of allegories on tombstone bas-reliefs, Olya and her two friends were sitting in silence. This was but a fleeting, momentary harmony of shadows, but Madame G. professed to have noticed that moment, or, more likely, she had set it aside in order to return to it a few months later. By spring, the revolver had grown. It belonged to Rudolf, but for a long time passed inconspicuously from one to the other, like a warm ring sliding on a string in a parlor game, or a playing card with Black Mary. Strange as it may seem, the idea of disappearing all three together, in order that, already in a different world, an ideal and flawless circle might be restored, was being developed most actively by Olya, although now it is hard to determine who first proposed it and when. The role of poet in this enterprise was taken by Yasha. His position seemed the most hopeless, since, after all, it was the most abstract. There are, however, sorrows that one does not cure by death, since they can be treated much more simply by life and its changing yearnings. A material bullet is powerless against them, while, on the other hand, it copes perfectly well with the coarser passions of hearts like Rudolph's and Olya's. A solution had now been found, and discussions of it became especially fascinating. In mid-April, at the flat the Chernyshevskys then had, something happened that apparently served as the final impulse for the denouement. Yasha's parents had peacefully left for the cinema across the street. Rudolph unexpectedly got drunk and let himself go. Yasha dragged him away from Olya, and all this happened in the bathroom. And presently, Rudolph, in tears, was picking up the money that had somehow fallen out of his trouser pockets. And what oppression all three felt, what shame, and how tempting was the relief offered by the finale scheduled for the next day. After dinner, on Thursday the 18th, which was also the 18th anniversary of the death of Olya's father, they equipped themselves with the revolver, which had become by now quite burly and independent, and in light, flimsy weather, with a damp west wind and the violet rust of pansies in every garden, set off on streetcar 57 for the Grunewald, where they planned to find a lonely spot and shoot themselves one after the other. They stood on the rear platform of the tram, all three wearing raincoats, with pale, puffy faces, and Yasha's big peaked cap, which he had not worn for about 4 years and had for some reason put on today, gave him an oddly plebeian look. Rudolph was hatless, and the wind ruffled his blonde hair, thrown back from the temples. Olya stood leaning against the rear railing, gripping the black stang with a white, firm hand that had a prominent ring on its index finger, and gazed with narrowed eyes at the streets flicking by, and all the time kept stepping by mistake on the treadle of the gentle little bell in the floor, intended for the huge, stone-like foot of the motorman when the rear of the car became the front. This group was noticed from inside the car, through the door, by Yuli Filipovich Posner, former tutor of a cousin of Yasha's. Leaning out quickly, he was an alert, self-confident person, he beckoned to Yasha, who, recognizing him, went inside. "Good thing I ran across you," said Posner. And after he had explained in detail that he was going with his 5-year-old daughter, sitting separately by a window with her rubber-soft nose pressed against the glass, to visit his wife in a maternity ward, he produced his wallet, and from the wallet his calling card. And then, taking advantage of an accidental stop made by the car, the trolley had come off the wire on a curve, crossed out his old address with a fountain pen and wrote the new one above it. "Here," he said, "give this to your cousin as soon as he comes back from Basel, and remind him, please, that he still has several of my books which I need very much." The tramcar was speeding along the Hohenzollern Damm, and on its rear platform Olya and Rudolph continued to stand just as sternly as before in the wind. But a certain mysterious change had occurred. By the act of leaving them alone, although only for a minute, Posner and his daughter got off very soon, Yasha had, as it were, broken the alliance, and had initiated his separation from them, so that when he rejoined them on the platform, he was, though as much unaware of it as they were, already on his own. And the invisible crack, in keeping with the law governing all cracks, continued irresistibly to creep and widen. In the solitude of the spring forest, where the wet dun birches, particularly the smaller ones, stood around blankly with all their attention turned inside themselves, not far from the dove-gray lake, on whose vast shore there was not a soul, except for a little man who was tossing a stick into the water at the request of his dog, they easily found a convenient, lonely spot, and right away got down to business. To be more exact, Yasha got down to business. He had that honesty of spirit that imparts to the most reckless act an almost everyday simplicity. He said he would shoot himself first, by right of seniority. He was a year older than Rudolph, and a month older than Olya. And this simple remark rendered unnecessary the stroke of drawn lots, which in its coarse blindness would probably have fallen on him anyway. And throwing off his raincoat, and without bidding his friends farewell, which was only natural in view of their identical destination, silently, with clumsy haste, he walked down the slippery, pine-covered slope into a ravine heavily overgrown with scrub oak and bramble bushes, which, despite April's limpidity, completely concealed him from the others. These two stood for a long time, waiting for the shot. They had no cigarettes with them, but Rudolph was clever enough to feel in the pocket of Yasha's raincoat where he found an unopened pack. The sky had grown overcast. The pines were rustling cautiously, and it seemed from below that their blind branches were groping for something. High above and fabulously fast, their long necks extended, two wild ducks flew past, one slightly behind the other. Afterwards, Yasha's mother used to show the visiting card, Diplomate Engineer Julius Posner, on the reverse of which Yasha had written in pencil, Mummy, Daddy, I am still alive. I am very scared. Forgive me. Finally, Rudolph could stand it no longer and climbed down to see what was the matter with him. Yasha was sitting on a log among last year's still unanswered leaves, but he did not turn. He only said, I'll be ready in a minute. There was something tense about his back, as if he were controlling an acute pain. Rudolph rejoined Olya, but no sooner had he reached her than both of them heard the dull pop of the shot. While in Yasha's room, life went on for a few more hours as if nothing had happened. The cast-off banana skin on a plate, the volume of Anyansky's poems, the cypress chest, and that of Khodasyevich's The Heavy Lyre on the chair by the bed, the ping-pong bat on the couch. He was killed outright. To revive him, however, Rudolph and Olya dragged him through the bushes to the reeds, and there desperately sprinkled him and rubbed him so that he was all smudged with earth, blood, and silt when the police later found the body. Then the two began calling for help, but nobody came. Architect Ferdinand Stockschmeisser had long since left with his wet setter. They returned to the place where they had waited for the shot, and here dusk begins to fall on the story. The one clear thing is that Rudolph, whether because a certain terrestrial vacancy had opened for him or because he was simply a coward, lost all desire to shoot himself. And Olya, even if she had persisted in her intention, could do nothing since he had immediately hidden the revolver. In the woods, where it had grown cold and dark, with a blind drizzle crepitating around, they remained for a long time until a stupidly late hour. Rumor has it that it was then that they became lovers, but this would be really too flat. At about midnight, at the corner of a street poetically named Lilac Lane, a police sergeant listened skeptically to their horrible, voluble tale. There is a kind of hysterical state that assumes the semblance of childish swaggering. If Madame Chernyshevsky had met Olya immediately after the event, then perhaps some kind of sentimental sense would have come of it for them both. Unfortunately, the meeting occurred only several months later, because in the first place, Olya went away, and in the second, Madame Chernyshevsky's grief did not immediately take on that industrious and even enraptured form that Fyodor found when he came on the scene. Olya was in a certain sense unlucky. It so happened that Olya had come back for her stepbrother's engagement party, and the house was full of guests. And when Madame Chernyshevsky arrived without warning, beneath a heavy mourning veil, with a choice selection from her sorrowful archives, photographs, letters, in her handbag, all prepared for the rapture of shared tears, she was met by a morosely polite, morosely impatient young woman in a semi-transparent dress with blood-red lips and a fat, white-powdered nose, and one could hear from the little side room where she took her guest the wailing of a phonograph. And, of course, no communion of souls came of it. "All I did was to take a long look at her," recounted Madame Chernyshevsky, after which she carefully snipped off, on many little snapshots, both Olya and Rudolf. The latter, however, had visited her at once, and had rolled at her feet and pounded his head on the soft corner of the divan, and then had walked off with his wonderful bouncy stride down the Kurfürstendamm, which glistened after a spring shower. Yasha's death had its most painful effect on his father. He had to spend the whole summer in the sanatorium, and he never really recovered. The partition dividing the room temperature of reason from the infinitely ugly, cold, ghostly world into which Yasha had passed suddenly crumbled, and to restore it was impossible, so that the gap had to be draped in makeshift fashion, and one tried not to look at the stirring folds. Ever since that day, the other world began to seep into his life. But there was no way of resolving this constant intercourse with Yasha's spirit, and he finally told his wife about it, in the vain hope that he might thus render harmless a phantom that secrecy had nurtured. The secrecy must have grown back, for soon he again had to seek the tedious, essentially mortal glass-and-rubber help of doctors. Thus he lived only half in our world, at which he grasped the more greedily and desperately, and when one listened to his sprightly speech and looked at his regular features, it was difficult to imagine the unearthly experiences of this healthy-looking, plump little man with his bald spot and the thin hair on either side. But then all the more strange was the convulsion that suddenly disfigured him. Also, the fact that sometimes for weeks on end he wore a gray cloth glove on his right hand, he suffered from eczema, hinted eerily at a mystery, as if repelled by life's unclean touch, or burned by another life, he was reserving his bare hand clasp for inhuman, hardly imaginable meetings. Meanwhile, nothing stopped with Yasha's death, and many interesting things were happening. In Russia, one observed the spread of abortions and the revival of summer houses. In England, there were strikes of some kind or other. Lenin met a sloppy end. Duse, Puccini, and Anatole France died. Mallory and Irvin perished near the summit of Everest. And old Prince Dolgorukki, in shoes of plaited leather thong, secretly visited Russia to see again the buckwheat in bloom. While in Berlin, three-wheeled taxis appeared, only to disappear again shortly afterwards, and the first dirigible slowly stepped across the ocean, and papers spoke a great deal about Kue, Chang Tso-lin, and Tutankhamun. And one Sunday, a young Berlin merchant with his locksmith friend set out on a trip to the country in a large four-wheeled cart with only the slightest smell of blood, rented from his neighbor, a butcher. Two fat servant maids and the merchant's two small children sat in plush chairs set on the wagon. The children cried. The merchant and his pal guzzled beer and drove the horses hard. The weather was beautiful, so that in their high spirits they deliberately hit a cleverly cornered cyclist, beat him up violently in the ditch, tore his portfolio to bits, he was an artist, and rolled on very happy. And when he had come to his senses, the artist overtook them in a tavern garden, but the policeman who tried to establish their identities was also beaten up, after which they very happily rolled on along the highway, and when they saw that police motorcycles were gaining on them, they opened fire with revolvers, and in the ensuing gunplay, a bullet killed the merry merchant's three-year-old son. "Listen, we ought to change the subject," Madame Chernyshevsky said softly. "I'm afraid to have my husband listen to things like that. You do have a new poem, don't you? Fyodor Konstantinovich is going to read us a poem, she proclaimed loudly. But Vasilyev, half reclining, having in one hand a monumental cigarette holder with a nicotineless cigarette, and with the other absent-mindedly tousling the doll, which was executing all kinds of emotional evolutions in his lap, nevertheless went on for a good half minute about how that gay incident had been investigated in court the previous day. Well, I haven't got anything with me, and I don't know anything by heart, Fyodor repeated several times. Chernyshevsky quickly turned to him and put his small, hairy hand on his sleeve. I have a feeling you're still cross with me. You're not? Word of honor? I realized afterwards what a cruel joke it was. You don't look well. How are things going? You never really did explain to me why you changed your lodgings. He explained. At the boarding house where he had lived for a year and a half, people he knew had suddenly moved in, very kind, innocently intrusive bores, who kept dropping in for a chat. Their room was near his, and before long Fyodor had the feeling that the wall between them had crumbled and he was defenseless. Of course, in the case of Yasha's father, no change of residence could possibly have helped. Vasilyev had got up. Whistling softly, his huge back bent slightly, he was examining the books on the shelves. He pulled one out, opened it, stopped whistling, and, wheezing instead, began reading the first page to himself. His place on the couch was taken by Lyubov Markovna and her large purse. Now that her tired eyes were naked, her expression grew softer, as with a seldom-humored hand she stroked the golden back of Tamara's head. "Yes," Vasilyev said abruptly, slamming the book shut and cramming it into the first available opening. "All things in the world must end, comrades. As for me, I must get up at 7 tomorrow." Engineer Kern took a look at his wrist. "Oh, stay a while longer," said Madame Chernyshevsky, her blue eyes beaming imploringly, and turning to the engineer, who had risen and stood behind his empty chair, which he slightly moved to one side. Thus a Russian merchant who has drunk his fill of tea might turn his glass upside down on its saucer. She started talking about the lecture he had agreed to deliver at the next Saturday meeting. Its title was Alexander Bloch in the War. "I put Bloch and War on the announcements by mistake," she said. "But it doesn't make any difference, does it?" "On the contrary, it certainly does make a difference," replied Kern with a smile on his thin lips, but with murder behind his thick eyeglasses, without unclasping his hands, which were joined on his abdomen. "Bloch in the War conveys the proper meaning, the personal nature of the speaker's own observations, while Bloch and War, if you will excuse me, is philosophy." And now they all began gradually to grow less distinct, to ripple with the random agitation of a fog, and then to vanish altogether. Their outlines, weaving in figure-eight patterns, were evaporating, though here and there a bright point still glowed, the cordial glint in an eye, the gleam of a bracelet. There was also a momentary reappearance of the intently furrowed forehead of Vasilyev, who was shaking somebody's already dissolving hand. And at the very last, there was a floating glimpse of a pistachio-colored straw decorated with silk roses, Lyubov Markovna's hat. And now everything was gone, and into the smoky parlor, without a sound, in his bedroom slippers, came Yasha, thinking that his father had already retired, and with a magic tinkling, by the light of crimson lanterns, dim beings were repairing the pavement at the corner of the square. And Fyodor, who did not have money for the streetcar, was walking home. He had forgotten to borrow from the Chernyshevskys those two or three marks that would have tided him over until he got paid for a lesson or translation. This thought alone would not have disturbed him, had he not been possessed by a general feeling of wretchedness consisting of that rotten disappointment he had imagined so vividly the success of his book, and a chill leak in his left shoe, and fear of the imminent night in a new place. He was tired. He was dissatisfied with himself for wasting the tender beginning of the night. and he was tormented by the feeling that there was some line of thought he had not pursued to its conclusion that day, and now could never finish. He was walking along streets that had already long since insinuated themselves into his acquaintance, and as if that were not enough, they expected affection. They had even purchased in advance, in his future memories, space next to St. Petersburg, an adjacent grave. He walked along these dark, glossy streets, and the blind houses retreated, backing or sidling into the brown sky of the Berlin night, which nevertheless had its soft spots here and there, spots that would melt under one's gaze, allowing it to obtain a few stars. Here at last is the square where we dined, and the tall brick church, and the still quite transparent poplar, resembling the nervous system of a giant. Here also is the public toilet, reminiscent of Baba Yaga's gingerbread cottage. In the gloom of the small public garden, crossed obliquely by the faint light of a street lamp, the beautiful girl who for the last 8 years had kept refusing to be incarnated, so vivid was the memory of his first love, was sitting on a cinder-gray bench. But when he got closer, he saw that only the bent shadow of the poplar trunk was sitting there. He turned into his street, plunging in it as in cold water. He was so loath to go back. Such melancholy was promised him by that room, that malevolent wardrobe, that daybed. He located his front door, disguised by darkness, and pulled out his keys. None of them would open the door. "What's this?" he muttered crossly, looking at the key bit, and then furiously began jamming it in again. "What the hell?" he exclaimed, and retreated one step in order to throw back his head and make out the house number. Yes, it was the right house. He was just about to bend over the lock once more when a sudden truth dawned upon him. These were, of course, the boarding house keys, which he had carried away in his raincoat pocket by mistake when he moved today, and the new ones must have remained in the room that he now wanted to get into much more than a moment ago. In those days, Berlin janitors were for the most part opulent bullies who had corpulent wives and belonged, out of petty bourgeois considerations, to the Communist Party. White Russian tenants quailed before them. Accustomed to subjection, we everywhere appoint over ourselves the shadow of supervision. Fyodor understood perfectly well how stupid it was to be afraid of an old fool with a bobbing Adam's apple, but still he could not bring himself to wake him up after midnight, to summon him up out of his giant feather bed, to perform the act of pushing the button, even though it was more than likely that no one would answer, squeeze as he might. He could not bring himself to do it, especially because he did not have that 10-pfennig coin, without which it was unthinkable to walk past the palm, grimly cupped at hip level, confident of receiving its tribute. "What a mess! What a mess!" he whispered, stepping away and feeling from behind the weight of a sleepless night settling on him from head to heels, a leaden twin whom he must carry somewhere or other. "How stupid! Как глупо!" he added, pronouncing the Russian glupo with a soft French L, as his father used to do, in a mildly jocular, absent-minded way when perplexed. He wondered what to do next. Wait for somebody to come out? Try to find the black-caped night watchman who looked after door locks on residential streets? Force himself, after all, to blow up the house by ringing the bell? Fyodor began pacing the sidewalk to the corner and back. The street was echoic and completely empty. High above it, milk-white lamps were suspended, each on its own transverse wire. Beneath the closest one, a ghostly circle swung with the breeze across the wet asphalt. And this swinging motion, which had no apparent relation to him, with a sonorous tambourine-like sound, nevertheless nudged something off the brink of his soul where that something had been resting, and now, no longer with the former distant call, but reverberating loudly and close by, rang out, "Thank you, my land, for your remotest..." And immediately on a returning wave, "Most cruel mist, my thanks are due." and again flying off in search of an answer, "By you unnoticed." He was somnambulistically talking to himself as he paced a non-existent sidewalk. His feet were guided by local consciousness, while the principal Fyodor Konstantinovich, and in fact the only Fyodor Konstantinovich that mattered, was already peering into the next shadowy strophe, which was swinging some yards away, and which was destined to resolve itself in a yet unknown but specifically promised harmony. "Thank you, my land," he began again, aloud, gathering momentum afresh. But suddenly the sidewalk turned back to stone under his feet. Everything around him began speaking at once, and, instantly sobered, he hurried to the door of his house, for now there was a light behind it. A middle-aged woman with high cheekbones, a caracole jacket over her shoulders, was letting a man out and had paused together with him at the door. "So don't forget to do it, dear," she was saying in a drab, everyday voice, when Fyodor arrived grinning and immediately recognized her. That morning she and her husband had been meeting their furniture. But he also recognized the visitor who was being let out. It was the young painter Romanov, whom he had run into a couple of times at the editorial offices of the Free Word. With an expression of surprise on his delicate face, whose Hellenic purity was spoiled by dull, crooked teeth, he greeted Fyodor. The latter awkwardly bowed to the lady, who was rearranging the jacket slipping from her shoulder, and then bounded up the stairs with enormous strides, tripped horribly at the bend, and climbed on holding the banister. Bleary-eyed Frau Staboy in her dressing gown was awesome, but that did not last long. In his room, he groped for the light and found it with difficulty. On the table, he saw the glistening keys and the white book. "That's already all over," he thought. Such a short time ago, he had been giving copies to friends with pretentious or platitudinous inscriptions, and now he was ashamed to recall those dedications and how all these last few days he had been nurtured by the joy of his book. But after all, nothing much had happened.